This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Congrats to Super Bowl champs, the Kansas City Chiefs, who broke their 50-year drought tonight, defeating the San Francisco 49ers, who were seeking their sixth Super Bowl ring. And the final score, 31-20, a remarkable comeback for the Chiefs. You may know him as the web producer for America's most popular overnight radio program, Coast to Coast AM. Lex Lonehood is also an accomplished writer, and his new book is called Nightmare Land: Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. And Lex is standing by, and he'll stay with us for the full 2 hours. Owen Wolf is my technical producer, and joined tonight in studio by his young apprentice, Carlos. Welcome aboard the crazy train, Carlos. Ryan White is our live stream producer, and we are live streaming tonight on the YouTube channel Strange Planet. Don't forget to hit that red sub button. We're heading towards 20,000 subscribers, and we need your help. Incidentally, the February issue of my free monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum, is just days away from being published. So, if you haven't subscribed, better do that fast, or you'll have to wait till March. Just go to strangeplanet.ca, and register your name and email address. It's that simple, and you'll start receiving Inner Sanctum for free every month in your in-mail box, and you'll also be automatically entered into the monthly draw for free Strange Planet merch, t-shirts, phone cases, hoodies, tote bags, and more. Go to strangeplanet.ca and register, and do it right now. We are about to embark on a mind-expanding exploration of sleep disorders and unusual dream states, the scientific explanations, and the paranormal possibilities. The sleeping mind is a mysterious backdrop that science is just beginning to shed light on. It was only some 60 years ago that researchers discovered REM, the rapid eye movement cycle associated with dreams. In Nightmare Land, Lex travels into the eerie borderlands, where the unconscious dreams and strange entities intermingle under the cover of night, revealing broader and hidden aspects of ourselves, from the savage and frightening to the astounding and sublime. Lex Lonehood-Nover has been the web producer for Coast to Coast AM, America's most popular overnight radio show, since 2002. His work is considered a valuable resource for anyone studying the paranormal, fringe science, and alternative theories. Hey, Lex, welcome aboard. How are you, my friend?
Hey, Richard, I'm doing good. I always enjoy working with you when you're hosting over at Coast to Coast, and it's a real pleasure to be on your show this evening.
Oh, likewise. I'm just delighted to have you. It's like we're family, a Coast to Coast family.
Right.
How did you sleep last night?
Furtively.
Well done. But, I mean, you, well, we'll get into your, you've had an interesting encounter, which actually predates your coast-to-coast days. So we'll get into that in a minute. But as I mentioned in the introduction, it's only been 60 years, hard to believe, when scientists first sort of began to understand something that we now take, for example, rapid eye movement, REM sleep. What else, what other big questions remain regarding our sleep state that we really don't know much about?
Well, I think one of the big outstanding questions that has not really been resolved is the purpose of dreaming. There's been different theories going back to antiquity. Freud certainly captured the imagination of the public, and I think his ideas are somewhat out of vogue now, and there's other theories, but in looking at it all, it just feels to me like none of it really completely answers the question, and it may be somewhat unanswerable. I think that medical researchers and scientists have some idea about the purpose of sleep overall and the different things that it does for the body and the brain. They've been able to show that. But as far as the purpose of dreaming, it's still pretty mysterious.
You begin the book with an examination of sleep paralysis, which to me has always been sort of the equivalent of swamp gas in ufology, where it's just this broad brush that's often used to dismiss so much of what goes on in what you call the borderland between the sleep state and wakefulness. Sleep paralysis. I'd like to begin the discussion with your own encounter with what may be a case of sleep paralysis, perhaps not. But take us back to 1999, and you were listening to all things of Art Bell on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny, ironic twist given the job I would end up having in a few short years and the popularity of that topic on the show over the years. But yeah, I was an Art Bell fan in the 90s. It's kind of what ended up drawing me to this career that I've had all these years. And one night I was kind of laying in a loft bed and listening to the show, and then it went into a commercial, and the classic signs of sleep paralysis for people that don't know is your body is completely frozen, and you can only move your eyes, and oftentimes what happens is you can start to see kind of a malevolent entity that starts to form in part of the bedroom, but you're actually looking out and seeing your regular bedroom, so you're not in a dream. And so as Art had gone to commercial, and I remember he was this kind of innocuous commercial for C. Crane shortwave radios, and I was seeing this malevolent entity that formed in the corner of the room, kind of like a spider's web, and this male figure was just looking at me like he wanted to kill me. It was just really terrifying. And as I mentioned, that my body was frozen, and this all happened within I would say probably under 30 seconds that I broke out of it.
And
so it's the kind of thing that can happen just as you're falling asleep, and more often when you're coming out of sleep, coming out of REM, the REM dream state.
Right. And what you experience turns out to be pretty universal. It cuts across all cultures, although, and it goes by different names depending on the cultural lens. There actually turns out to be an interesting Canadian connection, because in Newfoundland, one of our fine provinces, Newfoundland and Labrador, they did a study on old hag. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that actually was one of the big breakthroughs when there's a sociologist who studied these old hag reports in Newfoundland, and in fact, it was kind of a shorthand that people used to, instead of just trying to describe what sleep paralysis was and the different stages that they go through, they would just say old hag, and people would know right away what they were talking about. And Gifford really sort of put this on the map, and his research was one of the first to show that sleep paralysis happened to normal people, and that it wasn't really a sign of any kind of psychological disorder. And previously, people often thought that it was the sign of some kind of psychological pathology of some sort. So his work was really a breakthrough in that regard. But the classic old hag is kind of a description of a female figure that leans or sits on a person's chest.
Right, and it goes by different names in different cultures. Old hag in Newfoundland, and probably that came maybe from Great Britain. Interesting name for it in Japan, Kanashibari. What does that mean?
Well, it actually means bound by metal, and that's something that's also pretty well known in Japan. It's depicted in folk tales and manga, those comic books. Sometimes it's portrayed as kind of like a magical power that monks use to immobilize people and animals. So it's actually pretty well known in Japan.
How far back does it go, depictions of whatever name it goes by, old hag, or in Zanzibar it's called bat wing? How far back does it go in depictions in, let's say, art?
Well, there was some thought in something I ran across that it was even depicted in the some of the cave paintings in a way. I guess it would be hard to determine if that's actually what, you know, it's very interpretive as to what you're looking at with some of that material. But I do think it goes far back into antiquity. The Greeks and the Romans certainly knew about it and wrote about it.
And
back in those days, I think they attributed it to like kind of an indigestion type thing, or eating overly rich foods.
Right. It reminds me of that passage from Dickens' Christmas Carol when Ebenezer Scrooge tells the ghost of Jacob Marley, "You may be a bit of undigested beef. There's more gravy in you than grave." So that's what he was alluding to, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because sleep paralysis was actually that's what people, when they said nightmare, up until about the 1800s, that was the term that was used to describe what we think of as sleep paralysis, rather than how we define nightmare today, which are anxiety dreams that tend to wake a person up right out of the dream.
I guess the scientists refer to REM as paradoxical sleep. So what do the scientists actually believe is happening when someone is having an experience like you had over 20 years ago while listening to Art Bell, or someone else refers to as old hag or bat wing or metal bound or whatever they call it?
Well, I think it's according to neurologists and people of that ilk, they would consider what's happening to be kind of a superimposition or an intrusion from, it's like a leftover from the REM dream state. That intrudes into the waking state, and there definitely is some logic behind that, because what's happening in REM is that the body is paralyzed, so you don't get up and start acting out your dreams. So it makes sense in that regard that there is some kind of mixed state, and that's actually kind of the running theme in my book, is this idea of these mixed states of consciousness that combine different aspects of being asleep and awake. And yet, I still kind of felt like that explanation didn't quite seem to match up to the experience and the utter terror and oddness of seeing these apparitions or demonic beings that appear in people's rooms. There is a newer neurological explanation that I thought was interesting to consider. A scientist named V.S. Ramachandran, who came up with this theory that what happens when someone is experiencing sleep paralysis, they can't feel their limbs, and so there's a part of the brain that kind of materializes this ghost image of a body, sort of like a phantom limb syndrome, and that seemed really interesting to consider.
The fear and dread is one thing, but you raised the question as to whether this can actually kill you, sleep paralysis. Tell me about sudden unexplained nocturnal death syndrome. And there was, I don't know, we won't call it an epidemic, but an incredibly high rate of incidence for, I believe, South Asian immigrants to the United States back in the 1980s.
That's right. In fact, those incidents are what inspired Wes Craven to create the Freddy Krueger character from Nightmare on Elm Street. He read these accounts in the L.A. Times. It really was kind of a little mini epidemic. These young immigrants from Southeast Asia were dying at a rather unusual rate because they were young and healthy men, and people couldn't really figure out what was going on, other than they were, you know, kind of found screaming or something, just frozen in their beds, and they had died of something like a heart attack. And so it was a real medical mystery. And it wasn't really until years later that some research was done by Shelley Adler, who uncovered that these young men might have had this thing called Brugada syndrome, which is like a hidden heart defect, and in combination with something they call the nocebo effect, which is kind of like the dark twin of the placebo effect, that was what was doing them in. And it was all sort of related to seeing these entities in sleep paralysis, because their traditional belief system from Asia was that if they didn't keep their old traditions, some of them that involved animal sacrifice, that they could be visited by these entities. And so that's kind of what happened when they moved to America. They were dropping away from these old traditions, and then when they would have these sleep paralysis episodes, they would interpret that as being kind of this retribution for falling away from their old traditions.
Fascinating. So a perfect storm, a heart defect coupled with some cultural beliefs and an episode of sleep paralysis all come together and produce unexplained death syndrome.
Remarkable.
Lex Lonehood-Nover is with us. You may know him as the web producer on Coast to Coast AM, and his new book is Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. How much credence do you give to the non-scientific or the non-prosaic explanation for old hag or these other incidents? For example, you talk about an astral hypothesis. Let's delve into that for a few moments.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think it can entirely be ruled out. In fact, some people have described experiences where they wake up from sleep and there's an entity that's already on top of them, kind of like feeding on their energy, and the entity is described as being surprised that they're kind of caught in the act, that they thought the person that was sound asleep and wouldn't really see them there. So it strikes me that it could be possible that when we're in these certain states of consciousness, these kind of mixtures of being awake and asleep, we might be tuning in to some sort of astral realm or something that we wouldn't normally have access to when we're awake. So it's something that's really interesting to consider. I don't know that you could prove something like that, but it's interesting to ponder. What is your belief on it, Richard?
Well, I've stated, you know, on the radio many times that I do believe in an unseen realm. I believe in interdimensional entities. So then the question becomes: is the sleep paralysis somehow opening a portal to these dimensions? Is it simply a neurobiological? Is it a combination of both? Is it the interdimensional entities that are causing the sleep paralysis? So, you know, I guess scrabbling around in the dark like everyone else. I don't know, but I am certainly open to the, well, as you describe in the book, the astral hypothesis.
Yeah, and one thing that surprised me just in general and delving into this topic and talking to people about it, of just how many strange stories and experiences that people have. I think that it's sort of a lot of it's kept hidden by people. They don't want to seem like they're crazy or whatever, but it seemed like almost everyone that I talked to, if it wasn't sleep paralysis, it was some other strange experience that they had. So it seems like a real hornet's nest of strange things going on.
We're heading into a break in a couple minutes, but before we get to the break, we'll start the conversation, carry it on afterwards. To what extent in your research did you find a connection between a sleep paralysis and certain folkloric creatures, whether we're talking about vampires, Nosferatu, shadow people, witches, incubus, succubus, and so forth?
Well, certainly the incubus, succubus are kind of like the classic representations of sleep paralysis that have that kind of supernatural aspect. And it struck me that a lot of the whole witch persecution thing might have been related to that, because they were coming up with these theories of how the witches would have communion with these demonic figures, and it seemed to relate to some of the descriptions of sleep paralysis. So it made me wonder if some of that was, if even like these heads of the church had sleep paralysis experiences themselves and saw these strange entities and took that as proof that, oh, the devil does exist after all, and we've got to do something about it. And things like the vampire, I think that's another kind of classic case where you can see parallels to sleep paralysis in terms of people being frozen and unable to move, and a kind of evil figure that's literally feeding on the person, which is similar to what happens with some of these entities.
All right, Lex, stay put. We'll roll into a break here. On the other side, we'll talk about maybe a connection between sleep paralysis and out-of-body experiences. And we'll learn about your good friend of 25 years, Jimmy, and his extraordinary experiences. Lex Lonehood Nover, Nightmareland, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness, right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett.
Take a look around. What do you really see? This is where you can tell all about it. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. From a coast-to-coast AM insider, a mind-expanding exploration of sleep disorders and unusual dream states, the scientific explanations and the paranormal possibilities. Here's a nice little blurb on the back from our dear friend, the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley. An excellent exploration of the darker side of the dreamscape, a must-have book. And from my our colleague at Coast to Coast, George Knapp, a potent mix of modern media reports and bone-chilling lore worthy of John Keel and the Brothers Grimm. I wanted to ask you about the connection, Lex, between sleep paralysis and things like out-of-body experiences, astral travel, even Edgar Cayce, the great Edgar Cayce, often described as the sleeping prophet, the idea of remote viewing in that hypnagogic state. Talk to me about that a little bit. I know that's a big mouthful to chew on, but let's begin that discussion.
Well, I think if you were to view sleep paralysis as having some positive aspects, the whole idea that you could kind of piggyback into an out-of-body or astral travel would certainly be one thing that you could say about the experience, because there is some literature and reports where people are able to do just that, or convert it into a lucid dream, which is entering the dream state, in this case, while realizing that you're in a dream. So I think if you can get past the scariness and the whole frightful aspect of not being able to move your body, that you could actually have more of a positive experience. And it is interesting that these realms seem somewhat connected, in that this idea that, like you were bringing up about Edgar Cayce, I guess I would consider what he does to be more in that hypnagogic state, which is considered right before you fall asleep or just after you wake up, which really does seem to be kind of a gateway to psi and communications with the dead and all sorts of things. So I would categorize that kind of stuff in a slightly different vein than sleep paralysis, although it seems like that could be the jumping off point for those kind of experiences.
Tell me about your old friend Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, he would fall into that category that I was mentioning of people kind of coming out of the woodwork with their tales. And in his case, I knew he had a long-term fascination with the occult, but when I was telling him that I was writing this book and especially focusing on sleep paralysis, he started telling me, he goes, yeah, I had those experiences heavily for like 25 years, and I just thought it was funny that he had never mentioned that in all the time that I knew him. And he started having sleep paralysis when he was like 11 years old, and it really kind of came to a head when he was a medical student. And, you know, as you know, they don't get much sleep. They have to do these really long shifts at the hospital and just kind of catch a little shut-eye here and there, and he was just having, you know, nonstop all these various entities. Some of them, he said, were kind of like these menacing rubber doll creatures and these like Lovecraftian reptiles that were like cold as ice. And so he tried a bunch of different New Age methods, kind of trying to reason or, you know, engage these tormentors, and nothing really seemed to work. And so finally, one night, this gargoyle-like hag descended upon him while he was in a paralyzed state, and he managed to shift into a lucid dream, like I was mentioning before. So as the hag pushed him down, he suddenly had this like moment of clarity, and instead of trying to get away from her, he did the opposite. He pulled the hag closer, and to the shock of the creature, he ripped into her chest, tore out her heart, and ate it.
Oh,
so I kind of joke
Lord.
In the book. Well, that's one trick they don't teach you in medical school. But that technique actually worked. It seemed to, I don't know if you'd call it shamanic or something, seemed to transpire. And after that, the sleep paralysis episodes faded away and rarely occurred to him again.
I would guess that word would get round pretty quick in the old hag community that leave Jimmy alone because he'll rip your chest cavity open and eat your heart.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because a lot of the typical advice with nightmares and facing your monsters is to reason with them and try this sort of friendly approach. So it's funny that sometimes the more effective thing is to actually be violent with these entities.
Right,
that's
fight back.
Language they understand.
Sure, fight back. I wanted to talk a little bit about the alien abduction phenomenon, and because there are obvious parallels here, and not to, you know, explain the entire phenomenon away with sleep paralysis, but what did your research tell you about the possible connection?
You know, I wanted to include that in the book, Richard, because there was a period in the 90s when a couple of prominent psychologists came out and basically tried to write off the whole alien abduction thing, particularly the bedroom encounters, and just saying, well, it's really just mistaken sleep paralysis, and people all kind of know about these reports of the Greys, and they're all kind of jumping on this bandwagon. And it struck me that, yeah, some cases could involve that, but the sheer repetitiveness of the descriptions of those creatures with the wraparound eyes and the, you know, kind of egg heads and the spindly bodies and then the examinations aboard the ship and the hybrid babies, all of that, it just didn't really jibe with what I understood about the way people typically experience sleep paralysis. And by that, I mean, not everyone's demon is kind of like their own. I think it's a very idiosyncratic experience. So the idea that everyone would be seeing this exact same thing, that just didn't really make sense to me. So I wondered if it was something where, because I don't, it seems far-fetched, this idea like, oh, there's a UFO in someone's backyard and they're just kind of coming through the walls into the bedroom. But it ties in more with what we were talking about before of kind of like astral or interdimensional entities that are using the same kind of methodology or gateway to reach out to people, or people just becoming aware of these other kinds of experiences because they're in a different brain state.
Lex Lonehood Nover, my guest. The book is Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, yes, or Demons Involved as well, and Wakefulness. And just a reminder that we will open up the phone lines at the top of the hour and take questions and comments. I would be particularly interested in hearing about your strange experiences between, the wakefulness and the dream state. I just want to crib here from chapter 2 briefly and then get into a discussion about parasomnia. And because as you write here that sleep paralysis is just one of what you call a hornet's nest of conditions categorized as parasomnia. Although it's understood that there are just three primary states of being awake, REM dreaming, and deep sleep, each with their corresponding brainwave patterns, their parasomnias point toward a more porous mental model. When there's a hiccup in the system, the borders of these three states, again, awake, REM dreaming, and deep sleep, the borders of these three states can bleed or blend into each other, creating hybrids. And with that, about 75 clinical sleep disorders. Just give us kind of a quick sampling or a laundry list of some of the strange sleep disorders that you address in the book.
Well, first of all, just to define parasomnia, those are physical or emotional abnormal occurrences that accompany sleep or dreaming. Some of the classic things that everybody knows about are sleepwalking, sleep talking, there's sleep eating, there's sleep sex. So some of these are kind of involve multiple aspects, like if you're sleep eating, you're also sleepwalking. And there's some other fairly strange ones. There's something called REM behavior disorder. And you can almost look at that as kind of like sleep paralysis, but viewed through like a carnival funhouse mirror. Because in that condition, instead of being paralyzed when you wake up, you're still in the dream state, but your body is not paralyzed. And so these people are thrashing around and acting out their dreams. And typically people that have that syndrome have these very violent dreams, so their bed partners are in danger of being attacked. It's really quite frightening, and this is a case where it's helpful for people to get diagnosed at sleep clinics because they have some medications and things that can kind of control it. But in one case with this man who had that REM behavior disorder, he was in a dream where he saw this like skunk get into his tent, and so he was kind of in this struggle with the get the skunk out of the tent. And so he was like dragging this skunk out of the tent, and then meanwhile his wife, he was pulling in the waking state, his wife was like screaming because he was pulling on her long hair.
Oh dear.
So somehow he had kind of blended the waking reality of her long hair superimposed with the skunk.
Unbelievable. Listen, we'll take a quick time out. Lex, come back and discuss more. The Somnambulant Society, when The Conspiracy Show returns. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
Before we get back to my conversation with Lex Lonehood Nover, the author of Nightmare Land, just a quick programming note. Next week on this transmission, Marcus Allen will be with us. He's the British distributor and publisher of the UK edition of Nexus magazine. Many of you are familiar with Nexus. It deals with news and information that's, well, overlooked, unreported, or ignored by the mainstream media. Hidden history, future science, alternative health, conspiracies, UFOs, and we'll be talking about the lunar landing hoax. And Marcus always comes equipped with some pretty in-depth analysis, and I think some pretty credible evidence that at least the photographs of the lunar landing may have been staged. All right, let's talk about sleepwalking and sleep talking some more, Lex. Now, let me, a quick story. I have my middle older sister has been a sleepwalker all her life. I remember hearing stories of her walking, getting out of her crib, walking into the kitchen with her blanket, and dropping it in the garbage, and then going back into her crib. She was completely asleep. And this has continued on now into her adult life. She's 60. And, you know, I'll hear these crazy stories from my brother-in-law about finding my sister in the closet in the middle of the night, sort of battling with the coat hangers and things like that. How much of this, because, you know, I'm wondering if this is a symptom of sort of modern living, because sleep deprivation and sleep disorders seem to be almost epidemic. I'm wondering if there's a connection with modern living.
Well, that's a possibility. I think certainly things like insomnia, which are super common, I think you could chalk that up to the way we live. One little tidbit of research that I ran across that is kind of related just in terms of the way we sleep was that prior to the advent of electric lighting, people actually used to sleep in two shifts. So it was, you would sleep for one period, I guess sometime after nightfall, and then people would get up for an hour or so, kind of read by candlelight or just have various activities, and then go back for their second sleep. And so the whole idea of getting in your 8 hours in one big batch is somewhat of a modern contrivance. And with experiments where people kind of have gone down to like a cave or some area that's completely dark, they do actually revert back into that pattern of this kind of bifurcated period of sleep. So just in terms of modern living, I think maybe this whole notion that we're supposed to sleep for 8 hours does relate to some of the various disorders and experiences that people have.
Fascinating.
In regard to sleepwalking, it's thought to be pretty common in kids. They often grow out of it, I guess, not so much in the case of your sister. And the other thing is it does tend to run in families. There seem to be kind of a genetic component to it. This friend of mine told me this story that I recount in the book that is actually kind of amusing. If it wasn't so much to him, he was kind of horrified when it happened. But when he was a kid, back in New Jersey, and they lived in a split-level home, and his parents were going through a divorce, and so as a treat for my friend, his mom would let him stay up and watch Johnny Carson with her. And so one night they were down watching the TV, and all of a sudden his identical twin sisters, they were a few years younger than him, they both appeared at the top of the stairs, kind of arm in arm, and then they start coming down the stairs together with those glassy-eyed stares. They were sleepwalking together, He had never seen it. The mom was kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, she was sort of used to it. But to him, it was like that scene out of The Shining,
right.
with those twins.
Oh, my Lord. True or false, you should never wake someone while they're sleepwalking?
You know, that, I think, is one of those traditional beliefs, the idea that that your soul could be lost if you were suddenly awakened, that you're kind of traveling out of the body when you're asleep. I think the part of it that maybe has some truth to it is that you don't want to startle a sleepwalker. You kind of just want to just sort of gently guide them back to bed. they could get kind of disturbed. And then there's this whole thing of night terrors, which is, you could consider that kind of a subset of sleepwalking, but that is when people are having these really frightful nightmares, and they're just running around in absolute terror, and sometimes they have, like, superhuman strength where they're able to, like, you know, shove a big TV that they normally wouldn't even be able to move in their waking state. And what's really curious about night terrors and some of the other parasomnias is that they occur in non-REM, or this slow-wave sleep, or deep sleep, it's called. And that was kind of a revelation to me, because I thought, you know, during REM, that's when we have our dreams, but actually there's this content that's going on in the mind during non-REM sleep, and we usually have almost no memory of that. So that seemed like another one of those really mysteries of, like, okay, what is going on then? You know, it sort of speaks to the question of, well, what's going on in the mind of a sleepwalker? They do have some content that's going on there.
Right. As you point out in the book, getting back to sleepwalking for a moment, maybe we'll talk about this on the other side. We're heading into a break here, but sleepwalking in northern climes, like where I'm sitting tonight, can be most dangerous, as we'll discuss. Lex Lonehood-Nover, is the author of Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. And as we head into the top of the hour, you can also get your fingers moving and call into the program. We'll give you those numbers. We'll roll those numbers in a few moments. And I would love to hear your tales of sleepwalking, sleep talking, and other encounters, eerie encounters perhaps, in the borders of sleep, dreams, and wakefulness, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Loose lips sink ships, and sometimes corporations. Got something to say? Call Richard Serrett now at 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Before we get back to sleepwalking, sleep talking, sleep murder, I just want to dip into the mailbag very briefly. I don't know how this got misplaced in the mail, but I just wanted to mention to Lorraine and Matt, who sent me a Christmas card. I don't know, but maybe they're Eastern Orthodox or Eastern Orthodox. Dear Richard, we're big fans. Listen whenever possible. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Also enjoy when you fill in for George Norrie. Best wishes, Lorraine and Matt. Well, thank you so much for that. And a little bit later, I'll read a couple of nice cards and letters. All right, back to Lex Lonehood-Nover, and the book is Nightmare Land. Incidentally, how do we get a hold of this fine book, Lex?
Oh, thanks for asking. It's available on Amazon. Some booksellers, bricks and mortar stores like Barnes & Noble carry it. You can get it on IndieBound and a variety of places online. The audiobook I recommend as well if you're into that sort of thing. I got to help in the casting of the narrator, and this actor Neil Heligers really does a bang up job with it. He's got kind of this Rod Serling like voice that really kind of gives the whole thing a very entertaining and mysterious twist.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, this would be very conducive to an audiobook. Perhaps people can listen and help them drift off, or
yeah,
not.
it's kind of not maybe this sort of thing you want to listen to as you're falling asleep, but for other occasions, perhaps.
Sure, sure. I mentioned earlier about the perils of sleepwalking in northern climes. Tell me about this gentleman in Minneapolis.
Well, that was a case where a man woke up sleeping next to his wife, and he was in some distress, and the wife felt like a wetness in the bed, and she pulled back the covers, and the man's toes all had like frostbite on them, and you know, initially she was just perplexed as to what had happened, you know, amidst, you know, they were calling for an ambulance because it was a fairly serious situation. And what they pieced together was that he had gotten up and in his state of sleepwalking, he thought he was walking the dog, and because the wife was able to see, to trace his footsteps in the snow, because he was walking barefoot in the snow on the exact same route that they walked their dog. But in this case, the dog was safely and warmly sleeping at home. So he had just gotten right back into bed after this whole sleepwalking episode.
My word.
And in some cases, people are uncertain whether it's suicide or not, because they'll find a body like the next morning curled up in a snowbank. And it's only, you know, if they can piece together that someone was a known sleepwalker, that becomes the suspected thing that caused their death, rather than just allowing themselves to freeze to death.
How elaborate or what kind of complex activities can people do while they're asleep? Can they drive?
Yes, they can. In one case, someone was said to fly a helicopter. One of the sleep murder cases that I investigate in the book, actually in your home country there, Kenneth Parks was said to drive 14 miles to his in-law's apartment. So the whole state of sleepwalking is very curious, because what's happening is the person is using their eyes to be able to see, and a lot of the motor functions of the body are obviously operating if they're walking around, but certain key aspects of the brain are still asleep. The things that govern logic and rational thought, for instance, in the neocortex area. So someone could be using their eyes to see and drive a car, but they might not recognize someone that's extremely close to them. They wouldn't even know who they were. So it is really this strange hybrid state.
Fascinating. We have a program on this radio station called Midnight Blue that airs weeknights at 12 a.m. at midnight, of course. So you have a chapter sort of alluding to Midnight Blue, and that has to do with people who get rather amorous, but while they're asleep. Talk to me about sleep sex. Is that a thing?
Yeah. It's actually, the more clinical name is sexsomnia. And again, this is probably something that's been going on since time immemorial, but it wasn't until 2014 that it became an official diagnosis as a sleep disorder in sleep disorder clinics. A lot of times people enjoy it, and it's not something that that's a problem. There was one case that I profiled in the book where a woman's partner she kind of wasn't sure if he was asleep or not, you know, because he seemed kind of robotic and very amorous, if you will. And so at one point, right in the middle of their having sex, he started snoring. So it's kind of this phrase came up of the so-called snorgasm. But the idea that, you know, when she caught him in the act of snoring while having sex, that was like the clue that, okay, he is definitely asleep. But one of the curiosities about it is, in a lot of the cases, people, the awake partner would report that their sleeping sex partner was actually better. They were a better partner when they were asleep than they were when they were awake. You know, possibly because they were less inhibited and just, you know, were willing to kind of explore different things.
Right. We're heading into the top of the hour, and I do want to talk about people who have committed horrible crimes and use the defense that they were asleep. But in this particular case, sexsomnia, has anyone ever used that in a defense, let's say, for example, when the sexual encounter was unwanted?
Yeah, that it is. It's come up in a number of court cases, and it, you know, it's a controversial thing to be able to prove one way or the other. It's even come up in the reverse, where someone has accused another person of, you know, sexual impropriety, and they were the ones that had come on to them while they were in their sleep. So there's a lot of different permutations and complications. And for someone that has that as an issue, they really do need to be careful, because they could get themselves into trouble and do things that they would regret.
How would you prove something like that, that you were actually asleep?
It would be very difficult. I mean, it would be, in the case of these sleep crimes like murder, what they do in the defense is try to show a history of a person having various parasomnias. There's a machine called a polysomnogram that is used to detect abnormalities in a person's sleep. This whole thing with sleepwalking and sleep sex and sleep eating, it's what is considered to have a lower arousal threshold. So in other words, someone is more prone to wake up, like if an airplane is flying by, that's enough to wake them up into this partial state of awakening. So in these court cases, I think a lot of it is kind of getting sleep experts to demonstrate that the person did have various abnormalities.
All right. We will open up the phone lines and questions and comments. And again, would love to hear about your strange experiences somewhere in the borders of sleep, dreams, and wakefulness. And if you're a sleepwalker, a sleep talker, if you've had other strange experiences, we will open up the lines at 416-360-0740. That's in the Greater Toronto Area. 416-360-0740. And toll free from just about anywhere, 1-866-740-4740. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Back with more in a minute.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. A big howdy to each of you listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, 740 on the amplitude modulation band and 96.7 on the frequency modulation band here in Toronto. Hi all to those of you tuning in on one of our affiliate stations across North America, and hey you, checking out the live stream at zoomerradio.ca and on the YouTube channel, Strange Planet. And hello to those gathered in the live YouTube chat. However and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Lex Lonehood-Nover, web producer of Coast to Coast AM, is discussing his brilliant new book, Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. And I will also take calls this hour. We'd love to hear about your strange dreams, nightmares, and other strange and unexplained occurrences that you've experienced in a dream state, or perhaps on the border and of sleep and wakefulness. Before the break, we were talking about sleep murder. And is there a particular case that sort of caught your attention when you were putting this book together?
There are several of them. One of the most famous ones was the one I mentioned before, which took place near you in Canada. A fellow named Kenneth Parks. That was back in 1987. I don't know how well known that case is in Canada, but he had a history of various sleep problems, and he one night got out of bed and left his house just kind of with the door wide open and a number of things that seemed to indicate that he was sleepwalking, and he ended up driving 14 miles to his in-laws' home. And when he got there, he savagely attacked them with a kitchen knife that he got inside their home. And the whole thing was very bizarre, because these in-laws were very beloved to him. He had no reason to kill them. One of them actually survived the attacks, But one of the bizarre elements to the case that they used in the trial in his defense was that he, in the early morning hours, showed up at the police station and he was kind of muttering something about killing his in-laws, but all 10 tendons in his fingers had been completely cut through because of the kitchen knife being held so strongly in his hands during the attack, but he wasn't experiencing any pain. They called it dissociative analgesia, and that is something that a person that is sleepwalking might demonstrate, this idea that they don't feel pain during sleepwalking. And so this case went to trial, and it was kind of a battle of the sleep experts, and it was really one of the first modern cases where this whole theory was tested out in the legal system. And he actually was found innocent and got off scot-free, and the verdict was protested. It actually went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court that ended up honoring the verdict, but it certainly raises questions as to what is the culpability of someone when they're asleep. Do they still bear some responsibility for what they're doing? So it's really an interesting question, and some of the research that I ran across suggested that the court system is a little antiquated in the way that they view some of these automatic or unconscious behaviors.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the idea of guilty or not guilty seems somewhat limiting in these cases. Is what are there other levels of culpability then?
No, not really. I mean, that's why there's been suggestions to try to modify it to, at least, you know, in cases where someone is found not guilty because they were considered unconscious or sleepwalking, that they should be ordered to go on certain types of medication or take steps so that they will not repeat these behaviors again.
All right, go ahead, Lex.
Well, I was just going to say, I think I ran across cases where I think it was used more as like the so-called Twinkie defense, where there was a famous case in the 1800s where this kind of a scion of a wealthy family came. His lawyer was a sort of a Johnny Cochran of his day, and came up with that defense supposedly after seeing this novel about somnambulist, and he ended up getting off because of, you know, having this skillful lawyer and assembling various witnesses that claimed that he did sleepwalk. But he not only murdered his mistress, but he set fire to the abode. So it was kind of like a double crime.
Mm. Let's say hi to Chris in Etobicoke. Chris, you're on the line with Lex Lonehood Nover, the author of Nightmareland.
Well, hello there.
Hi.
Hi there. Well, a dream I'd like to discuss that I've had, which was a very strange encounter, was a few years ago, and I was having a symptom of sleep paralysis, but I was able to get up in the dream. And the weirdest thing I experienced is that for some reason in these dreams, you're not able to use lights in your room. And for some reason, the clock would always be off. Like, I had a digital clock by my bed, and every time in this dream, I could see my room, but the clock would be out, and I would get up to open the door, but the lights would not work and the door would be stuck. And then I would end up in that thing where, you know, where we talk about the old hag or one of those, and I would feel that presence. And it's a strange encounter that certain things, that even if you are able to get certain forms of motion in these dreams, are not able to be used. You just cannot use things in your realm.
All right. Great question. Great comment, rather, Chris. Lex, did you want to weigh in on that?
Well, a couple things came to mind. There's something called false awakening, and it sounded a little bit like what he was describing, where a person wakes up out of bed, maybe gets up and starts their day, only to realize that they're still in the dream state. And that can be quite disconcerting. There was fellow that is kind of a prominent figure in the lucid dreaming community, Robert Wagner, and he suffered from, I think, 7 false awakenings all in a row. And at that point, he was like, I'm going to give the whole lucid dreaming thing a rest for a while, because it was so disturbing to keep having these levels of one dream on top of the next, if you will. The other thing in terms of that whole experience is relates to something that I find frustrating about I guess you could call it the dream fabric, which is the where dreams take place. It seems like a lot of technology doesn't work, and in fact that's a cue to become lucid, what they have called reality checks, where you figure out that you're in a dream while you're still in the dream. But I think it's one reason why up to 2/3 of all dreams are negative or have a negative cast to them. And my pet theory is it's because of this whole reality of the dream world, where stuff doesn't work. And you know, nowadays where, you know, our phone is like, you know, a fifth appendage. And if you've ever tried to use a cell phone while you're in a dream, it's very frustrating. They don't work. And I often have dreams where I've left something behind and try to go back to get it, but because you're kind of, your mind is spinning out. You have like a different visual cortex that's being used when you're dreaming, and it's just sort of creating reality on the fly. So if you left your shoes back in one building, you can't necessarily go back to get it, because the whole reality is just kind of coming off the cuff. And because we don't realize that we're in a dream, that can lead to these frustrations and negativity.
Chris, thank you for that. Let's say hi to Louise is in Barrie, Ontario this morning. Louise, welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
Hi.
Hi.
I have, over the years, but as I get older, I see dead people in my dreams. I dream about my friends that are already gone. And I find it unsettling, and yet the dreams are not disturbing. They're pleasant.
Right.
And I'm wondering, are these people... I know this sounds ridiculous.
Not on this program, Louise. No, I know what you're going to say.
But are they trying to get in touch with me? Are they waiting for me?
Sure, that's a legitimate question people have. Are you dreaming it, or is this some way that the those that have passed on can communicate with us? This is something that we've discussed many times in this program. Lex, what are your thoughts?
I really believe that. I had a friend, this was a few years back, and a week after she passed on, she did get in touch with me, and she was so happy. She was just ecstatic. She said, it's wonderful here.
Well, I think that's kind of a universal experience, Louise, that you've had.
But it was during a dream, and she was beckoning me, and I told her daughter later, she said, it's a good thing you didn't, or you might have. I said, no, I'm sorry, Jill, I have to go.
You're not ready to go.
Right. I said, I have something I have to do. And so
did you,
I just
Louise, realize that these people that you had the dreams about, did you realize that they were deceased while you were in the dream, or did you just think they were visiting?
In some cases,
like
they were younger,
they were still alive,
and they are always pleasant dreams.
But they were younger in the dream than they would have been.
We were doing things. You know what I mean? We were perhaps functioning in some way. I've dreamed of my brothers who are both gone. I've dreamed, well, I'm in my 80s, so everybody's gone.
Well, Lex, what do you think? What are your thoughts on this? Are we just dreaming, or are we contacting the other side?
I think it's a question we all wonder about, because I think most of us have had dreams that involved the deceased, and I had one while I was actually writing the book. A good friend of mine had passed away, And I was experimenting with a supplement that is supposed to increase the chances of having lucid dreams. It's called galantamine. And it didn't generally induce lucidity, but it kind of made me a little smarter. I think it sends certain neurotransmitters, makes your brain a little peppier, but you're still able to sleep on it. So when I saw Jeffrey in the dream, even though I didn't realize it was in a dream, I did realize that he was dead, and that led to some very interesting conversation, because I was able to, kind of like Louise, ask about the afterlife. And most of the time, though, when I've had dreams involving dead people, I don't realize that they're dead, and it doesn't feel quite as remarkable as when you do know that they've passed on. As to whether these are legitimate visitations or they're just imagined in our mind, it really is hard to say. In the case of this encounter with Jeffrey, I was able to check in real life some of the things that he said to see if they were accurate or not.
Just in terms of dreams in general, when people have, universally, there seems to be certain archetypes, I guess, is the term for it. For years, I had dreams of my teeth falling out. That's very common. People have that. People have another universal one is, you know, you're speaking somewhere, or you arrive somewhere to speak and realize that you're not wearing any pants. The other one is, you know, you're going back to high school. You're late for exam, and then you realize you haven't studied. You haven't even attended class all semester. These are just universal. Where does that come from? Where do these archetypes or these symbols come from, do you think?
It's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, there's the Jungian archetypes, like the shadow and different things like that, that he argued are just part of everyone's consciousness, kind of this material that's buried inside of us. I think to some degree it might be cultural, because I saw reports that people in different countries have dreams that are a little different in terms of these repeated ones like you were describing. So some of it might be, you know, related to our social upbringing. As far as how you interpret those, I kind of take the view that rather than looking up their meaning in a book, that each person's interpretation might be unique to them as to the meaning of it.
Let's say good morning to Carol here in Toronto. Carol, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. Is Carol there? Hello, Carol. Can you lock in Carol on the other side? There we go. Hi, Carol. Good morning. Let's try Carol one more time.
Hi.
Hi there. You're on.
Hi. Thanks, Richard. The reason why I'm calling tonight is mine is more of an out-of-body experience. This was an actual out-of-body experience with a demon.
Oh, my. All right. Do tell.
Yes. I was in bed one night, and it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. I was asleep, and I could feel my soul go right out of my body. And I was now at the bottom corner of my bed with a light directly on me. And on the other side of the bed was a demon, blacker than night, and he had a lion's mane. I could see the outline of the lion's mane, and it was some type of communication. What do you call that, Richard, when you're not speaking, but it's like a mind?
Telepathy? Is that telepathy?
Yes, that's it. When whatever this thing wanted, it wanted my soul. I said no, and no sooner when I said no, I felt my soul go back into my body, and I felt pain again. When I was out of the body, I had no pain. When I went back into my body, I was in full of pain again.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and that was a spiritual, and I get old hag all the time. I won't sleep on my back anymore, because that's when she comes.
What does she look like?
The old hag?
Yes.
Terrifying. Terrifying. And I'm...
Whoops, sorry. I think we lost Carol there. Apologies, Carol. You dropped off. Did you want to respond to that before we head into a break, Lex?
Well, just briefly to say that, yeah, sleeping on your back is the one of the prime things that makes you susceptible to sleep paralysis. A lot of people are not back sleepers, but they might find themselves in that position, you know, when they're twisting and turning through the night. So there's actually a little bit of a remedy that for people that are plagued with sleep paralysis, where they sew something like a tennis ball into the back of the t-shirt or pajamas that they sleep in, and that'll prevent you from sleeping on your back.
All right. I think I got time to squeeze one more in here. Let's say hi to Paul is in Oshawa, our old friend Paul. Hello, Paul. Good morning.
Sure. Good morning, Richard. How you keeping?
I'm well, thank you. Yourself? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Very good show. And, Lex, a very interesting subject. I have a couple of questions for you, Lex.
Sure.
In regards to sleep paralysis or that dream state of having experience with different types of entities, have you had any cases where thereafter maybe the person has talked about any markings on their body and or had any awake paranormal activity such as ghost symptoms or UFOs?
In terms of the sleep paralysis with markings on the body, I don't think that's something I ran across. I mean, certainly in the alien abduction accounts, there are many tales of triangular marks on the body and different things like that. In terms of places that are said to be haunted or have poltergeists, there definitely seems to be a relationship between nightmares and strange spectral activity. All seems to kind of go hand in hand together.
All right, Paul.
And what about UFO sightings, Lex? I'm curious on that. Any cases on that?
I think that in terms of some of the alien abduction stuff, you know, sightings might be related, but I didn't necessarily see that in terms of sleep paralysis and other nighttime oddities.
Paul, thank you for the call. We'll head on into a break and continue to field your questions and comments as we discuss Nightmare Land. 416-360-0740 in the Greater Toronto Area, 416-360-0740, and toll free from just about anywhere, 1-866-740-4740.
Big Brother is listening. And so are you. To The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. Lex Lonehood Nover is with us. The book is Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. Let's, before we go back to the calls, talk a little bit about sleep deprivation, which any new parent certainly can identify with. People that work strange hours, shift work, etc., can lead to sleep deprivation. Can it actually kill?
You know, I did run across a case that's fairly recent, a Chinese fellow that was a huge soccer fan. The games were broadcast in China at odd hours in the middle of the night, so he ended up doing this marathon, I think, over 11 nights. He was just staying up and then going to work, and he, at the end of the whole series of games, he dropped dead, and there was some speculation that he had been kind of partying and drinking as well as not sleeping, so that might have been the combination of the other things that he ingested. But I also look at this syndrome called fatal familial insomnia, or FFI. It's a rare genetic disorder where people fall into this strange netherland, neither being able to be fully awake or fully asleep, and that does eventually kill people.
What's the longest you can go without sleep?
I think what happens is you would enter into a pretty psychotic state after even just after one day, you can start to have hallucinations and things. I don't know the exact figure that, you know, it probably varies from person to person, where it would actually cause death. But certainly, going back to like the medieval or Renaissance periods, they perfected sleep deprivation as a method of torture. And so they came up with all sorts of insidious ways of keeping people awake. And then in the 20th century, those gulags in Stalinist Russia were notorious for using that, because it didn't leave marks on people, and yet it was considered such an extreme form of torture that these prisoners would sign anything, say anything, do anything just to get some sleep. They said it was, the lack of sleep was far worse than food or just about anything else.
Fascinating. Let's say hi to Mike in Mississauga, Ontario. Mike, good morning. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Hi, Richard. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got two instances of dreaming. When I was very, very young, for about 3 years straight, I would have these dreams where I was dreaming with my eyes open and I'd be talking, and it would just really scare the you-know-what out of my parents, because I was saying all these names and talking, but I was like sitting up in bed, my eyes were open, but they couldn't wake me up. And I'd always wake up in the kitchen with all the lights on, and they would wake the dog up, they would wake my brother up, everybody would be up trying to wake me out of this trance that I was in.
Fascinating and scary.
It was scary.
Yeah,
for them.
It sounds like what I was talking about earlier of the night terrors, which is something that happens during non-REM sleep, even though there is this content, you're reacting to something that's going on in the dream state, although it's not the rapid eye movement, because your eyes are open in this kind of glassy-eyed or zombie thing. Do you remember the storyline of what was going on during any of those episodes?
Yeah, it's bizarre. I do remember it. All I remember is I was seeing nothing but all these bright colors, like oranges and bright reds and bright yellows. And when they asked me what was the problem, I would always say the same thing, that my father had died. It was bizarre. I don't know how that all connects. But my second example is a few years ago, you know, I had this dream about my older brother, and I never dream about family members. I hardly would ever dream. I was a really, you know, dead sleeper. And I woke up just after 3 a.m, and I thought, man, that's really unusual to dream about my brother. And I got up, you know, and I did my business. And then 6 days later, I found out that my brother had died. And they pronounced him dead on the table just after 3 a.m. And that was bizarre. And the night that he died, I had that dream, but I didn't find out till 6 days later.
Fascinating. Prescient dreams.
Yeah, there's certainly a long history of that kind of precognition that people report of different incidents that are particularly meaningful that they seem to get cued into. You know, in this case, it sounded like these kind of apparitions that sometimes people see, where their grandmother or someone appears at their bed at the said to be the same time that they're dying in the hospital, and that it's, you know, interpreted as like, oh, they're visiting someone one last time before they go. And in those cases, I would relate it more to like the hypnagogic state, where you have these odd experiences just before falling asleep or just after waking up. But certainly the dream state itself, there's a long history of these precognitive dreams that people have had.
Mike, thank you for that. I wanted to talk a little bit about sleep deprivation some more, and you reference some, you know, DJs. Back in the day, that was very popular. They would see how long they could stay on the air. I think you made the example. You cite the example of Alan Freed, who coined the term rock and roll. I was thinking also. I don't know that it's covered in the book, but there's a fascinating story that was shared with me by our mutual late colleague, R. Gary Patterson, a rock and roll investigator. It had to do with the Big Bopper, who. J.P. Richardson Jr., who was a DJ in Beaumont, Texas, and shortly before that airplane crash, in February of 1959. My word, we're coming up on the, what is that now, 61 years, the anniversary coming up very soon. He was involved in one of these all, you know, these marathons, on-air marathons, and he stayed up, I don't know how long it was. He was in, eventually he was carried out on a stretcher, and he was having this hallucination, and he was basically predicting the plane crash. How often does that happen? These hallucinations that are induced by insomnia or staying awake, and then these things turn out to be true.
That is a really interesting case that I did not hear about. The things that I looked at, people would fall into these kind of paranoid states. Peter Tripp was the DJ that that I profiled in the book, and he at one point thought that it was an undertaker, that he was doing a live broadcast from a glass booth in Times Square, and this fellow in a dark jacket showed up, and he was convinced that it was an undertaker that had arrived to take his body out that had died. So people can really fall into these strange notions when they've been sleep deprived.
Fascinating. Let's say hi to Destry is in Philadelphia this morning. Good morning, Destry.
How you doing, sir?
I'm well.
Listen, it's kind of weird how I found you. I was down here looking for a screw to fix a fire extinguisher and turn the radio on and found you. And you really raised a question to me that's been on my mind for a while. I just wanted to ask, is it common if you're dreaming, if you dream that you're driving with somebody in the truck that's passed? Like they're sitting next to you in your dream and you're talking to them, and the next day you wake up and it's like so for real that you actually think they're still alive. Does that happen or no?
Well, we were just chatting about that whole issue and the question that I think that everybody that has a dream that they realize even during the dream or sometime later that person is deceased, we wonder, could it really be them? Because you could make the argument that someone in spirit form, it's far more probable that they could communicate to us through something like a dream state than trying to get our attention in the waking world. I think it's hard to know one way or another for certain.
Destry, what do you think?
Man, I'm totally shocked. I'm going to be tuning into you for a while here because there's so many questions I got. I don't want to hog the radio up, but it's just that you touched on something that's been on my mind, and I was kind of embarrassed. I mean, I told my wife a few times, but I've had quite a few dreams where I'm talking to people. Nothing bad, no horror story or nothing, but, you know, just people, like a few times, if I may say this, they put a boot in a crotch, if you understand what I mean.
Yes, yes.
And it actually seems like maybe they're talking to me to say straighten yourself out or different things, you know, get to work here or do this. Nothing bad, though. But I just wondered, is that common? Because it's so real when I wake up.
Oh, yes.
A few times I woke up that I actually thought my father was still alive, you know, and all of a sudden I come to that cold feeling that, my father's, he's passed, you know.
Destry, it's no accident you found this radio program, and you'll find that if you listen, that what you've experienced is very common indeed. And for some people, it's very comforting. For other people, it's a little unsettling. Destry, thank you so much for calling in. I hope you'll call again.
Hey, not a problem, man. I'm going to keep the radio station locked here. I mean, it's just an old radio down the basement, but I just want to thank you because it was something I didn't expect to hear, and, it gives me a little relief knowing that there's other people maybe out there going through the same thing, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely, Destry. We'll be here waiting for you next week and the week after and the week after. All right, we'll take a quick time out. More of my conversation with Lex Lonehood Nover. Nightmare Land, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
PIN numbers, passcodes, social insurance numbers. If they make you wonder how private they are, here's two more numbers. 416-360-0740.
or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. If you like The Conspiracy Show, you might also be interested in my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited, and three episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Conspiracy Unlimited. To subscribe, to listen, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com, and it's available wherever fine podcasts are available, now available on Spotify. Back with Lex Lonehood-Nover, Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. Again, Lex, how do we get the book?
Oh, Richard, it's available on Amazon, actual bookstores like Barnes & Noble, IndieBound, anywhere you shop for books, basically.
And that audio version?
Yeah, same thing. You can get that through Audible or various places online that sell audio books. I'm actually a fan of the public library system as well, so I know my book and the audio version are carried in some libraries. If you're into that whole thing, you can request that that they carry Nightmare Land, so that's another way to access it.
Fantastic. Now, you talk about nightmares in the book. Obviously, that's the name of the that's the name of the book, Nightmare Land. But there's a wonderful phrasing that you used. You talk about dreams, how often dreams are an escape from our waking life. Because that's where we experience, you know, fantasies and different things. Whereas nightmares, it's often the wakefulness that rescue us from the nightmare. We wake up just before, you know, we're devoured by that monster. Let's talk a little bit about nightmares, how they may differ from dreams. I mean, are they essentially the same as a dream, except, you know, they're frightening, or are they a different thing altogether?
Well, like I mentioned earlier in our conversation, the definition of nightmare up until a certain point in the 19th century actually referred to sleep paralysis. But what we call nightmares now are actually a subset of REM dreaming. That's these very narrative, story-like dreams that we have, and it's coupled with what they discovered are the rapid eye movement in the eyes, kind of flicking back and forth. And what particularly fascinated me about nightmares was some of the really mind-bending ones, things like fever dreams and people having specific nightmares when they have medical conditions or are on different medications. So there's some things that just really are quite incredible. For instance, this fellow that wrote what you might consider to be like the first addiction memoir was about called Confessions of an Opium Eater, Thomas De Quincey. So he was addicted to opium, but he would have these nightmares when he would go to sleep that were just these extreme bendings of time and space. So for instance, in these elaborate dreams that he would have, it would seem as though it would go on for like 100 years within just the space of a night, and he would have all sorts of distortions of faces and buildings and things that seemed very characteristic related to the substances that he was on.
That's so true. The amazing thing about dreams is they can seem like they go on for hours and hours. What do we know about the average duration of a dream? Are they? I've heard that they can be just like seconds long.
Yeah, I think they can kind of run the gamut. We know that the REM sleep state occurs as part of a cycle that we go through. So when you first fall asleep, there are, I think, three or four stages of this non-REM or slow-wave sleep that go deeper and deeper into it. And then you hit REM, which are these narrative dreams, and then the cycle just repeats all over again. With nightmares, they often happen closer to the early morning as the person is going to be waking up within an hour or two, because there's more REM dreaming that happens in the later stages of sleep.
We're going to head into a break again here very shortly, and then we'll get to Mickey in Burlington and James and Melanie in Toronto and Richard in Hamilton. Do you have a, I don't know if you want to share this, I'm going to ask, I'll put you on the spot. Do you have a recurring dream?
I have had recurring themes that that give one cause to pause. I've not had that type of nightmare that I look at in the book, where someone is just plagued by something that plays out over and over again, that usually relates to some kind of unresolved trauma or issue in their life. But just as a kind of a side note about that, I've noticed that it seems almost like dreams have a separate memory in our brain, because I've gone back to different locations repeatedly that are not places I know in my waking life. So I've always been kind of fascinated by that.
Indeed. All right. Let's head on into the break, and then on the other side, we'll get to some more calls and more of my conversation with Lex Lonehood Nover. Nightmareland travels at the borders of sleep, dreams, and wakefulness as we head on into the stretch right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
Different views make great conversation. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Alex, one of the things I enjoy doing on this program, or Coast to Coast, is talking with inventors. And one particular inventor in Spokane said something to me I thought was very astute. And he said that before you invent something, you invent it first in the dream state, and then you invent it for real. And I know that you allude to sort of creativity while we're asleep. Talk to me a little bit about that. What's happening there?
Well, I particularly looked at that issue surrounding hypnagogia and some techniques that people like Thomas Edison used, as well as the painter Salvador Dali. They came up with these ways to kind of wake themselves up using these little contraptions, so they would just fall into that kind of half sleep state, and in so doing, they could grab, like in the case of Dali, I think that's where he saw some of these amazing surreal images just as he was about to fall asleep. And one of the more famous cases of someone using that state was the chemist Kekulé, who saw the benzene, the compounds, the molecular compounds for benzene, while he was falling asleep. So it definitely seems like we can access this material that is unconscious or subconscious, that it's almost like a real creative fountainhead that you can tap into.
Do you believe in the notion of a collective unconscious? Unconscious?
I think there's something to it. Yeah, this idea that parts of our brain are very ancient, and that there are these shared experiences layers that are kind of native to all of us in one way or another.
Mickey's in Burlington. Good morning, Mickey. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. Mickey in Burlington. Can you lock him in there? Thank you. Mickey going once. There he is. Mickey, hello.
Hello. It's Richard, Lex. Thanks for taking me on.
My pleasure.
Great. So I had a dream where I was actually, I woke up, rather, not a dream. I had been sleeping. I woke up, and I realized that my dog, Gabriel, was sitting beside me awake on his haunches, staring at the window. So I go, what's he staring at? And as I turned to look out the window, it was a curtained window, but behind it was all this undulating light. So the rational part of my brain thought, there must be an emergency service vehicle out there, ambulance, fire truck, whatever. This is at night, middle of the night. And I also thought to myself at the time, well, it's going to leave soon. And if it does, it'll go either to the left or to the right, because the road passes in front of this window. When it did leave, it went straight up. When I turned to look to Gabriel, who was still beside me, my dog, he was also raising his head to follow this light go straight up. And what was really odd is that my curiosity button was turned off. As normally, if you see emergency vehicles outside your window, it's just kind of a curious, normal human response to go, well, what is it? What are they out there for?
Sure.
What's going on?
Right.
But it's like my curiosity button was turned off. Not once did I get up for about 5 or 10 minutes to go and look. And then when my curiosity button, for lack of a better word of what to call that part of yourself, was turned back on, I mysteriously went to the back of the house and looked out into the backyard instead. So that's it. That was the experience. And I just have one other further thing, and it's in connected to sleepwalking. I had a roommate once back in the early 80s, and this fellow would get up and do really strange things. So I had a couple of experiences with him doing this, my history.
What name one strange thing he did while he was asleep.
Well, he would urinate in the room against the wall.
Ah.
So odd things. And another time he did it on himself. He didn't even get up out of his bed. He just did it on himself.
Oh, dear.
And anyway, and no recollection later that this had happened. So with that in mind, and I was aware that that had happened in the past, one night I woke up from sleep and I was on my stomach face down. And then I realized that I couldn't move. And I realized that I couldn't move because there was this tremendous weight on my back. And I was trying to struggle to move because I couldn't breathe. And what it felt like to me was as if someone was on my back, kneeling on my back and holding the back of my head into my pillow.
Classic old hag, right, Lex?
Well, yeah, except that the odd thing about it is that normally those kind of experiences would be the pressure would be on the chest. I'd not heard of a case where the body was flipped around like that, but
I'm sure that
there are cases like that.
I was face down, and I was suffocating. I was really struggling to move who I thought was my roommate off my back. And finally, I lost consciousness, woke up later the next morning, asked him if he was aware of anything like that happening. He said no. So anyway, I know there's other callers, so that's my story. I'll let you guys go. If you have anything to say about it, I'll be listening. So
Mickey, thank you so much. Thank you for that. Let's move quickly, see if we can fit in Melanie here in Toronto. Melanie, good morning. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I don't really believe in dreams, but I can't help it because I have dreams where sometimes either an object or a person or a situation or a place that I dream about within days, weeks, or even months then appears in reality, in real life. And it's very shocking to me. But then I read the Bible and dreams do happen. Joseph and all these others have dreams. But I'll just tell you a very quick story. I had a dream that my aunt was on a bus and I was going to get on that bus. And she says, no, you can't get on the bus. Get off the bus. And we were very close. And so the bus closed and I left. And actually, when I then drove by in reality on the street where that bus is its route, it's the name of the cemetery where my aunt was buried, because she had passed away when I dreamt about her. And my sister in another city that same time had a dream where in reality she was on the bus, and my sister was horrified that this was my aunt in the front of the bus looking backwards at her. And I says, you must be dreaming. This can't be. She says, I know it was our aunt on the bus at the same time that I had a dream that I was going on the bus, and the street was the name of the cemetery she's buried.
Remarkable. That's a great story, Melanie. Thank you for sharing. Let me ask you very quickly, Lex, do you have any stories about people who share a dream? They're both actually in the same dream at the same time?
You know, I have run across that. It's definitely something that's very rare, but I think it definitely happens to people. It's been something that in the lucid dreaming world they've wondered if they could show that in an experiment to see if two people that are both lucid, in other words, knowing that they're dreaming while they're dreaming, could have some kind of shared experience together. So it's really out there at the edges of experimentation with some of these strange states.
Let's try to squeeze Richard in Hamilton, Ontario, onto the program. Richard, go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. Yes, regarding about the sleepwalking.
Yes.
As the gentleman say about the case of Ken Park.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I remember that he was sitting with his wife. They had a couple of drinks at night. And then they have the key, the car key, hanging up on the where they keep the key. And then the wife say, okay, I'm going to bed, good night. And then he jumped, he got the key and he jumped in his car and go kill his parents, his in-law parents.
Mm.
And then he got away out of it. How can you drive the car about 40 or 50 kilometers?
Well, Richard, as Lex pointed out earlier, people have been known to drive while asleep. You can do some pretty remarkable things while you're asleep. Richard, we've got to leave it there because we're out of time. Lex, this has just been remarkable, and congratulations on Nightmare Land, Travels at the Borders of Sleep, Dreams, and Wakefulness. What's up next? What are you going to work on now?
Well, I'm kind of milling what might be my next project and just kind of riding the wave of Nightmare Land. But it was a real pleasure to speak with you and your listeners tonight, Richard. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Likewise. And I'll be sitting in the Coast Air Chair Saturday, February the 8th. Maybe we'll be working together.
Cool. We'll catch you there.
All right, my friend. Lex Lonehood Nover, Nightmare Land, available where all good bookstores or all good books are available. All right, my thanks to Owen Wolf and his able young apprentice, Carlos, Ryan White, for live stream producing. Back next week with Marcus Allen from Nexus Magazine. We'll talk about the lunar landing hoax. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.